From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And the next stop for the Democrats running for president is Nevada, which holds its caucuses a week from Saturday. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders claimed victory last night in New Hampshire, but former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, was right behind.
You asserted that famous independent streak. And thanks to you, a campaign that some said shouldn't be here at all has shown that we are here to stay.
There was also a surge in enthusiasm for Senator Amy Klobuchar, who finished third. Senator Elizabeth Warren and former Vice President Joe Biden came in a distant fourth and fifth. We're joined now by Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan, who is supporting Bernie Sanders. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, congratulations on your win last night. But when you look at that win in New Hampshire by Senator Sanders, it was by less than 2% over Pete Buttigieg in a state that neighbors Vermont, where Senator Sanders is from. And we should point out that in 2016, he beat Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire 60-37%. Is that the win you were hoping for?
Well, there were only a few candidates last time. This time, I think there's at least eight. So we were glad to come out on top. That's the most votes in Iowa, the most votes in New Hampshire. And now we're going to take that to Nevada and South Carolina in a Super Tuesday. So I think the fact that Bernie Sanders got the most votes in the first two contests is very significant.
Does it worry you that if you add up the support for the more moderate candidates, and let's just say Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, and Joe Biden, it's a lot more than what Bernie Sanders got last night?
Yeah, I don't think people voted just on ideology. I mean, in some cases, people thought someone from the upper Midwest could win in the upper Midwest, so they voted for Amy Klobuchar, and people had all different reasons for voting. What we do know about Bernie Sanders is the issues he's advocating for: Green New Deal, universal health care as a right, raising minimum wage. All those issues are 60-80% support with the public. So we know he's running on issues that resonate well, and he also is the candidate who's got more of the first-time voters supporting him. And at the end of the day, in places like Wisconsin, a must-win state, we only win by having new voters come out to make sure that we can have those electoral college votes go for the Democrat.
How is Sanders going to compete when it comes to black and brown voters? He's only in third place in the polls in South Carolina, for example, behind Biden and Steyer, well behind Biden and Steyer.
Yeah, actually, a new national poll came out. Bernie was ahead of Biden with voters of color. I think he had the most vote for Latinos in Iowa. So he's definitely starting to win in those areas. And Nevada will be that first true test. And I think you're going to see Bernie Sanders come out on top in Nevada as well.
Where is he going to be spending his time in the next couple of weeks? Will he be in Nevada and South Carolina and Super Tuesday states, or is he going to pick one?
Yeah, I think he's going to, obviously Nevada is coming up very quickly, but also I think he's going to spend some time in some of the other Super Tuesday states. You know, Bernie Sanders has been tireless. He's gotten everywhere. He's campaigned hard, and I think that's going to continue to resonate with voters.
You brought up universal health care, which is, of course, a cornerstone of Bernie Sanders' candidacy. And it would involve getting rid of people's private health insurance coverage. How do you, as a surrogate of the campaign, think that that is going to happen, given that with almost 60 Democratic votes in the Senate, President Obama couldn't even get a public option into the Affordable Care Act?
So a lot of the pundits and the corporate-funded think tanks in D.C. want to make this be a problem. What's interesting is when they had exit polls in New Hampshire, people said this was one of the biggest issues for them when they went to vote. So real people think different than paid pundits. This is an important issue to them, and that's why it's resonating in Bernie's winning states when it comes to people coming out to vote. So I'm not worried about the political establishment that wants to spin this issue differently. On the ground, real people are concerned about not having health care, and I think that's why Bernie's doing so well, and I hope he continues to drive this message home.
But it's not spinning it differently. I'm just saying that the last time there was a major overhaul in health care and the Senate was overwhelmingly controlled by Democrats, that even that minimal step when it compares to Bernie Sanders and what he wants to do of a public option couldn't get through.
Yeah, well, there's no question that politicians are too often listening to special interests in Washington, D.C., but that's not where the public's at. And part of Bernie Sanders' campaign is about building a movement. It's not me, us. At the end of the day, we're going to use that electoral power to try to make sure that people in Congress have to do the right thing. And the right thing is making sure that every person has access to health care.
Are you concerned that this campaign is going to get nasty between now and Super Tuesday and that the Democratic Party could end up being fractured?
You know, I would hope not. I mean, you know, this is one, at the end of the day, we have to defeat Donald Trump. We have to be unified. Bernie Sanders was very clear in New Hampshire at the big dinner that Saturday night. First thing he let out with was the fact that we're going to have unity and get behind the candidate. And I hope all the other candidates will do the same thing. And I think, you know, if you really talk to voters about the issues they care about the most, that's why Bernie's connecting with people. And at the end of the day, when he's the nominee, I think everyone will coalesce behind him.
That is Mark Pocan, who is a Democratic congressman from Wisconsin and a Bernie Sanders surrogate. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, today, President Trump reacted to Attorney General William Barr intervening in the Roger Stone case earlier this week, replacing the recommendation that the president's close friends serve a 7 to 9 year sentence with a filing for a much lesser sentence. Yesterday, four prosecutors resigned from the case after Barr intervened. One quit his job entirely. But today, President Trump praised Barr, tweeting out, "Congratulations for taking charge of a case that was totally out of control. Evidence now clearly shows that the Mueller scam was improperly brought and tainted. Even Bob Mueller lied to Congress." Roger Stone's case grew out of the Mueller report. He was convicted for lying to Congress, among other things. Carol Lee, national political reporter for NBC News, has been reporting on this. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Well, this can get confusing, so let's walk through.
Yeah,
on Monday, the prosecutors in the case recommended a 7 to 9 year sentence for Stone. Then early the next day, President Trump called that recommendation horrible and unfair. Later that same day, the Justice Department submitted a second filing asking for far less than the 7 to 9 years recommended and said they made that decision before the president's tweet. What is your takeaway from this?
Well, a couple things. There's this whole question hanging over this of the independence of the Justice Department and White House interference and who Barr is serving, whether he's serving the country or he's serving the president. And then there's just the larger picture of this particular case with Roger Stone and what's going on inside the Justice Department. It's not unusual for prosecutors and higher-ups to have disagreements over sentencing. Usually, though, those things are worked out, and then there's a sentencing memo that's filed, and that's what everybody agrees to, and everyone's on the same page. Here, you're just seeing a breakdown in all of those sorts of processes and norms.
Well, Stone was convicted of witness tampering, lying to Congress, obstruction of a House investigation into the Trump campaign, and potential coordination with Russia ahead of 2016. You know, even those who are appalled by what they see as the president signaling to the attorney general to get involved, including Jeffrey Toobin, the legal analyst on CNN, have said that that sentence might have been a little bit long, but that there were other avenues. I mean, what are the other avenues? Could the Justice Department or someone go back to the judge?
Right. So basically what the prosecutor said is we're going to adhere to the sentencing guidelines and recommend what is within the federal sentencing guidelines, that is this 7 to 9 years in prison. They could have said, actually, there's a compelling reason why those guidelines should be circumvented, and they chose not to do that. And part of what experts of this will tell you is typically you would have the guidelines and then it goes before a judge. The recommendation goes before a judge and then the judge makes the call. And it would be unusual for a judge to throw the book at someone like Roger Stone, for instance, and go with the maximum sentencing guidelines. There's wiggle room in there for that, for it to play out there. So again, there were other ways for this to play out that could have gotten to the ultimate outcome that we now have, which is that there's a recommendation for a lesser sentence and Roger Stone is likely to not have to serve 7 to 9 years in prison. But we didn't see that happening. And all of that suggests that there's a lot of turmoil at the Justice Department right now.
Well, Senate Minority Leader Schumer is now calling on the DOJ Inspector General to investigate Barr's decision. What does the Department of Justice say about what happened?
Well, they're saying that they were blindsided by this, which is a little hard to believe just because this is something that was being debated internally and it was such a high profile case. And given all of the circumstances around it, that it's hard to imagine that the higher ups at the Justice Department would have been blindsided by the prosecutor's decision on sentencing. They're saying they were blindsided by this. It was not appropriate. that it didn't accurately reflect the Department of Justice's position on what would be reasonable. Their sentence should be far less. They didn't specify. And they were taking into consideration, they're asking the judge to take into consideration things like Roger Stone's age. He's 67 years old. His personal circumstances, his lack of criminal history, as the judge decides what sentence Roger Stone should serve, which will happen on February 20th.
What are people who have been around the DOJ for a long time, what are they saying?
Well, we Chuck Rosenberg, who's a former U.S. attorney in Virginia, has told us that this signals to him that there has been a political infestation in the Justice Department. And he said, quote, "And that is the single most dangerous thing you can do to the Justice Department." You know, Gregory Brower, a former U.S. attorney for Nevada, said he had never seen this happen before, ever. And he said, "I'd be shocked if the judge didn't order the U.S. attorney to come into court to explain it. So we may see some further explanation that the Justice Department has to provide."
That's Carol Lee, national political reporter for NBC News. Carol, thank you.
Thank you.
What's good, y'all? As you know, February is Black History Month, and all throughout that month, NPR's Code Switch is going to be running a special series about the history of Black resistance. Because as long as Black folks have been oppressed in this country, which is, you know, forever, we've also been fighting back. Listen and subscribe.
Maybe the most anticipated Silicon Valley IPO this year will be Airbnb. The company was valued at $31 billion in its last funding round in 2017 and said it plans to go public this year. As part of our series of conversations with leaders called View from the Top, we're joined now from San Francisco by Airbnb CEO and co-founder Brian Chesky. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on the show today.
So Airbnb has plans to go public this year. Can you say when that will happen?
Can't say when, but we are working really hard to make sure that we are set up to be a successful company once we are public.
Why do you want to go public now, especially after we've seen so many big tech IPOs bomb?
Well, you know, we're more than a decade old, and there's a couple of reasons a company would go public. There's really two big reasons. One is you need the money. The other is that you have shareholders and you want to be able to give them some liquidity. Now, we don't need the money, but because we're more than 10 years old, we do want to be able to offer a market for people to be able to sell their stock. It's obviously that makes sense. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, whether it's a good time or a bad time, I think very few people are going to remember how we went public. They're just going to remember who we are as a public company. And I ultimately think successful IPOs are really just successful companies going public in the grand scheme of things.
Now, you mentioned you want to give people an opportunity to sell their stock. Uber's co-founder and former CEO Travis Kalanick sold almost $1.7 billion worth of Uber stock right after the company's post-IPO lockup period. Would you commit to holding on to your stock for a period of time, or would you be ready to sell your stock as well?
You know, I started this company with two of my co-founders, Joe and Nate, and we think of ourselves as like really long-term holders. We've sold very little stock since we started the company, and we are absolutely not going to be doing anything other than running this company for the long run, and you know, we are going to maintain our really large positions.
As the head of one of the most prominent companies in Silicon Valley, what do you think of people who are worried that we might be near the end of a tech bubble?
I started Airbnb with my two co-founders in the recession. And I remember one time I met with an investor. We were trying to raise money. And the investor essentially said, you know, the economy's so bad, we don't want to invest in good companies. So we certainly can't give money to this crazy idea of strangers staying with other strangers. When I told somebody else about this idea, I remember they looked at me and they said, "Brian?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "I hope that's not the only idea you're working on." And so I think, what's the lesson there? Well, I think the lesson is that, like, maybe my co-founders and I were so naive to think this was actually a good idea, that people were on balance mostly good, and that if you build a platform for trust, two people could actually have an exchange. They could actually, one could bring the other into their world. I think this kind of idea is an idea that works irrespective of the economy. And in fact, during the Great Recession of 2008-2009, People were turning to Airbnb to try to be able to keep their home. So you may remember many people were losing their homes. They couldn't afford it. And that's really the roots. The roots of very much Airbnb is, you know, people like my co-founder and I who couldn't afford to pay rent, but realized the extra space we had, we could rent out to other people and be able to make some income. And so, you know, I think it's going to endure, and people want to save money. People want to meet other interesting people. And that's going to happen regardless of where we are on the economic cycle.
You announced recently that you want Airbnb to think about all stakeholders when it comes to corporate governance, not just investors. You call that being a 21st century company. Yes. What would that mean in practical terms?
So in practical terms, what it really means is I think historically the way a public company CEO has kind of been expected to operate is to serve one constituent, shareholders. I think in practically speaking, though, that's not the way society expects CEOs to operate. We expect the CEOs to think about the customer. We expect CEOs to actually think about the impact they have in the world. And frankly, what I would say is the best thing for shareholders are companies that society wants to exist. And society's not going to want companies to exist if they don't think they actually are taking them into consideration. So what would this mean? What it would mean is that you would define all your different stakeholders. That's step one. So we defined our guest, our host, communities we operate in, our employees, our shareholders. Then you would basically, you know, write down the kind of principles, what you're going to do to serve each of these stakeholders. The next thing is probably the most important. You actually measure your impact on your stakeholders. And you take the measurements of all the impact on all your stakeholders really, really seriously. Instead of having an annual shareholder day, you would have a stakeholder day. So it's not a major change of how you run the company. It just widens your aperture a little bit to take some other constituents into account.
It's not about giving hosts shares in the company or voting in the company.
There's many different ways you can serve different stakeholders. So, for example, we have millions of hosts in our platform. Our hosts, have over 7 million homes in over 190 countries. They've earned over $80 billion since we started this company, $80 billion. Now, are there other ways to deepen our partnership with hosts? There are a variety of ways, and we're looking at those ways.
I want to ask you about some of the issues that have come up in the news. Airbnb has, as you know, been criticized for driving up rents in very expensive cities. Do you feel any responsibility for the housing affordability crisis in this country, given how much your company has grown and gotten out there all over this this country and all over the world?
You know, the reason we started this company was that my co-founder and I were living in San Francisco. We couldn't afford to pay rent. All the hotels in San Francisco that one weekend we started the company were sold out. And we had an idea. We said, what if we can turn our house into a bed and breakfast for this design conference coming to San Francisco? Unfortunately, I didn't have any beds, but my roommate Joe had 3 air beds. We pulled the air beds out of the closet. We inflated them. We called it airbedandbreakfast.com. The reason I tell you that story is the reason we started this company is because we couldn't afford to pay rent. And many people turned to us originally because they couldn't afford to pay rent. The majority of our hosts tell us that they use Airbnb to be able to pay rent and afford to stay in the homes they live in. Now, that is what we think the majority story is. That being said, I think it's very important for CEOs of companies to really consider the responsibility and impact they have on society. I think we in the industry have had to learn, sometimes the hard way, that we have to continue to take more responsibility for activity on our platform. And so one of our 21st century principles was we want to strengthen the communities we serve. That means if we are having a negative impact on a community, we want to remediate that. And so what we've done in hundreds of cities around the world is we've made agreements. Those agreements, first of all, usually include taxes. So we will collect hotel occupancy tax. We collect about $2 billion. And then often they'll put in place restrictions, and we'll comply with those restrictions as well. So I never want to describe our community as all one thing or all the other, but we want to be responsible. And if there are negative impacts that our community is having, we want to be able to remediate that situation.
Well, you say you'll comply with those restrictions, but in many cases, you fight those restrictions that cities try to put on Airbnb and short-term rentals, for example.
Well, first of all, these are usually debates. They're debates that happen among many different constituents. But when there's settled law, we comply with that law.
What about the criticism that you're, in some cases, turning neighborhoods that used to be filled with people who actually live there and have a stake in the community into neighborhoods filled with tourists?
Well, first of all, I think that the vast majority of people renting their homes on Airbnb are renting the homes they live in. Now, I think it really depends on the neighborhood, but we want to make sure that we strengthen the community and the character of cities. And so, you know, again, it goes back to working city by city. We want to treat each city personally. And, you know, we have complied with numerous restrictions on cities who want to limit the amount of Airbnbs rented in certain neighborhoods. Oftentimes, they want to restrict the number of nights. And we will, of course, work with those cities and give them the data they need to be able to make the right decisions for their communities. The most important thing is we want to make sure that when people travel, they can stay in communities and that those communities are real communities. So we want to really help strengthen these communities.
What do you make of the news that many of the people who are now listing their Airbnbs are actually hospitality professionals? The website, The Information, found the number of Airbnb listings likely to be operated by hospitality professionals grew 36% last year, more than three times the increase in listings for rentals or spare rooms. Is there a professionalization of Airbnb hosting going on?
Well, the vast majority of people are just regular people. We do have professional hospitality companies coming onto our platform, including hotels. So we have hotels coming on their platform. We have bed and breakfast. And the reason they're coming on is we're one of the largest travel communities in the world. We do welcome more professional providers of hospitality, but the vast majority of people on Airbnb are people renting their homes. Now, when you go on Airbnb, you may see a home, it looks empty, and you may wonder, does somebody live there? It really depends, but the vast majority of these people are renting the homes they live in.
Are you worried about competition from hotel companies? We spoke with the head of Marriott International recently, who said that they're looking into getting into short-term rentals too.
You know, I think it's really important that you're mindful of competition, but what the main thing I'm worried about is, are people having incredible experiences when they use Airbnb? Do communities want to embrace Airbnb? And that is how we're going to be remembered. And if we create a product that people completely love, then we're not going to have to worry about what other people are offering.
That is Airbnb co-founder and CEO Brian Chesky. We'll continue our conversation tomorrow, asking about how Airbnb is responding to violent incidents in rentals, as well as discrimination against renters, and what Chesky plans to do with his $4 billion fortune.
And the dust has settled. Presidential candidates are now taking stock after yesterday's New Hampshire primary. Bernie Sanders had a clear victory, followed closely by Pete Buttigieg and the New Hampshire surprise, Amy Klobuchar. Elizabeth Warren came in a distant fourth, Joe Biden fifth. He left the state early to campaign in South Carolina. And now Andrew Yang, Michael Bennett, and Deval Patrick have all quit the race. Let's bring in NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Hi, Danielle.
Hey, Robin.
So Pete Buttigieg, Bernie Sanders, really neck and neck in Iowa and New Hampshire, but polling shows Sanders, you know, may have an edge in the more diverse states of Nevada and South Carolina. So can we anoint him front runner?
I mean, like you said, they are neck and neck in the delegate count. You have Sanders at 21 and Buttigieg at 22. But, yeah, like you've also said, in national polls and in the, to be honest, relatively few polls we have from South Carolina and Nevada, you do have Sanders really far ahead of Buttigieg, or quite far ahead in a lot of them. So, I mean, frontrunner is such a messy, nebulous word. So, but it is clear that Sanders is quite strong. Yeah. I mean, that is without a doubt. And compared to the guy that he is neck and neck with, he has a lot of strength. He has more strength going forward, it looks like. But let's be clear, non-white voters have largely not weighed in yet, and that is a big thing we're watching for.
Well, and that's what Joe Biden is watching for. He saw the writing on the wall in New Hampshire, left before totals were in to campaign in South Carolina, banking on southern states and the African-American vote. What are you hearing about what those losses, though, in Iowa and New Hampshire mean?
I mean, basically, long story short, they make South Carolina and Nevada that much more important for Joe Biden. And, you know, listen, he is pretty popular in South Carolina and he knows it and he is really hoping to capitalize on that energy there. But energy is the key word, I think, to watch with Joe Biden. I've seen him in New Hampshire and Iowa, and those are states where he did not have a super energetic, enthusiastic following that I saw when I was there. So in South Carolina, he really has to build that up, I think. I mean, not just get people to support him, but be enthusiastic about it.
Yeah. Boy, Amy Klobuchar sure did have crowds this past weekend. She had a great debate. But what else is drawing voters to her in New Hampshire and Iowa?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's one part of it is that she is a fighter, that she and that she showed that on the debate stage, as you alluded to, that she really got up there and took aim, especially at Pete Buttigieg. What she is trying to position herself as is a moderate alternative. And you do have, you know, some voters out there who say, listen, Sanders is a little too progressive for me. Warren is a little too progressive for me. I want someone else. And I think that Amy Klobuchar, for a lot of voters, is just getting her first look.
Well, Warren is also now trying to appeal to moderates. She had that fourth place disappointing finish. What are you hearing from voters about what happened?
You know, voters, overwhelmingly, a lot of voters you talk to, no matter what candidates' events they're at, they will say, you know, I like Elizabeth Warren. There are a lot of voters who are open to her. But when it comes to her being number one for a lot of them, lately she has struggled with that. She has fallen off in the polls in the last few months. You know, she has a lot of strengths. Voters like that she understands their economic problems, that she is smart, that she is capable. That is the image she has created for herself with her whole "I have a plan for that" thing. And she is a very effective speaker. But right now she's kind of in this no man's land where she is not – where a lot of progressives have their person in Sanders, but she's a little too liberal for some moderates. So she really has to figure out how she can pick up more people.
And no woman's land. NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Follow Danielle on Twitter, by the way.
The United States could soon have its first new particle collider in decades. Earlier this year, the Department of Energy announced that Brookhaven National Laboratory in Upton, New York, will be home to the Electron-Ion Collider, which will investigate what's inside two subatomic particles, protons and neutrons. For more, we're joined by Paul DeBar, who is Undersecretary for Science for the Department of Energy. He's in Washington. Paul, welcome. And what will this new collider do? How does it work?
So if you think about this will be an electron collider. And if you think about it, it's very much like an electron microscope, where we're going to be accelerating electrons, which are obviously, you know, much, much smaller than a proton or a neutron, to basically be an electron microscope where we're shooting electrons at the protons or neutrons to image protons and neutrons. And you need to, you know, accelerate it to very high levels of energy in order to basically shoot it to do the mapping, a little bit like an MRI or a CT scan, for the inner workings of matter.
And it will go how fast when it's being accelerated around? In a circle, right?
Yeah. So the way it will work is that we will accelerate – we will generate an electron beam and accelerate it to very, very close to the speed of light. We measure it by how much energy level that we will impart into the electron beam. We will start at 100 giga electron volts, which is a lot of energy. And that will be done by us generating these electron streams and then accelerating them in a circle. And we basically circle around them, imparting energy into the electron beam until it reaches the level that we want it to, so that we can image the protons and neutrons.
Do you anticipate any practical applications coming out of this research, or are these really first and foremost about basic science?
Well, the basic science research that this country has done, and we have led particle physics since World War II, since the Manhattan Project, and a lot of the technologies that we use today have come out of the basic research that came out of the national labs, including in physics. These accelerators can be used for many different things. The first one is medical isotopes that are used for cancer treatment. So I think as many people know, you look at nuclear medicine and nuclear imaging, which is a core part of the medical community right now for treating diseases. that these accelerators can produce those isotopes on the nuclear medicine side that are really critical. And many times you have to produce them very locally. You have to have accelerators around the country to make these isotopes because they decay relatively quickly, some of them. And so for us to move forward, that certainly helps the medical area. Another one, which is I think very interesting here in the near term, is around quantum information technologies. Utilizing quantum, which is inputting data into atoms rather than transistors, is basically a particle physics problem. And so the same equipment that we're looking at, technology that we're developing here, and we've developed in the past for kind of older versions of accelerators, is the exact same particle technology that will be used for the upcoming quantum computing and the quantum internet.
Mm-hmm.
Another area is around detectors. The MRI machine came out of the DOE National nuclear physics work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we certainly expect that we will have improvements in MRI and CT machines from detectors, just like when we helped invent them.
So if there are so many practical applications, how come this is the first new particle collider that has been built in this country in decades?
You know, there's a bit of a history around these accelerators. They cost a lot of money. There was one that was looked at a couple of decades ago called the Superconducting Super Collider, which ran into some siting and challenges. The U.S. decided to invest in CERN and the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva for that particular piece of science. We've been focusing on other areas. So one of them has been a neutrino piece of infrastructure at Fermilab outside of Chicago.
Which we profiled on this show. And actually, our listeners can go and listen to our story about that at hereandnow.org if they want to. It's a very interesting bit of research that's being done out there.
Yeah. I mean, that one, we accelerate protons in order to generate neutrinos to do neutrino research, which also helps us evaluate how the universe was created. So we've been investing in Europe for some colliders over the last, the near term. And by the way, we continue. That is, for that particular type of collider, we're increasing our investment by the United States into the collider at CERN. But we decided to take a look at to building this particular collider in the U.S. I think a key thing for your listeners to kind of understand is that the budgets for the Office of Science and science in general at the federal level, including NASA and the National Science Foundation and National Institutes of Health, are at all-time highs. And we're very excited about the support that very bipartisan support from both Congress and ultimately President signing the budgets for all-time highs. So we're very excited about that.
This collider is going to cost between $1.6 and $2.6 billion and should be up and running by 2030. Why does it take so long to build it?
So first of all, one of the advantages of this particular site and building it here is that we're actually using some existing collider infrastructure. There is a collider at Brookhaven National Lab right now called RIC, which is a relativistic hadron collider. So there's already a loop there that was accelerating other types of ions. There was an accelerator already infrastructure there. And so we're going to finish that mission in terms of imaging for nuclear physics in 2024. Between now and then, we're actually going to be starting both the engineering design in more detail as well as design around components like the accelerators. And then in 2024, when we take down the RIC collider at Brookhaven National Lab, then we'll start actually installing. And so from then, it will take about 6 years to both do the construction and then do the commissioning and startup.
Now, as you know, when you do a big project like this, the people in New York State are going to be very happy. And there's also a site in Virginia that was hoping to get this as well. Why not pick the Virginia site?
So, the Office of Science does things by having a very methodical process. And we had a process in which this recommendation and the selection was done by the scientists underneath me. You know, we have 17 labs. I love them all equally, just like my children. But, you know, we were doing this based on the data and the data of cost, the data around the team, data around the technology, You know, so there's a number of data points that came in to the team. I think the important thing about the 17, you know, national lab complex that we run is that each one kind of supports each other. And the lab in Virginia, Jefferson Lab in Newport News, is certainly an expert in actually manufacturing these accelerators, driving technologies. And frankly, a lot of the other labs, like at Fermilab and at SLAC at Stanford, benefit right now from the accelerators that were designed and manufactured at there. So we certainly expect that they will have a very leading role in that. And there's a number of other things that we expect them to also take the lead on in terms of computing and data management, which is becoming increasingly important with the amount of data that we're generating out of these facilities.
Okay, I'm going to finally just ask you a silly question, or you'll probably think it's silly, which is you say that the particle accelerator will be able to accelerate to near the speed of light. You can never actually get to the actual speed of light, right?
That is correct. There's a great T-shirt out there that one of my scientists has, which has a T-shirt that says speed limit and it says C on it.
And why is that?
As any piece of matter approaches the speed of light, there's a number of different things that happen. But one thing in particular is that the mass changes of that particular particle. And so as you approach the speed of light, that mass change makes it increasingly hard to get faster and faster. And as you reach the speed of light, you reach an infinite amount of energy needed to get to that last mm-hmm. step. And therefore, we cannot do that.
That is Paul DeBar, who is Undersecretary for Science for the U.S. Department of Energy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
The death toll from COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus, has reached a new high. Health officials in China say there were 108 new deaths Tuesday. That's the highest single-day fatality count since the outbreak began. The total death toll in China now exceeds 1,000. In Japan, an official from the health ministry who inspected passengers aboard a cruise ship that was under quarantine has now tested positive for COVID-19. But let's go to Beijing to get the latest from NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Robin.
So tell us more about the latest on the rate of new infections.
They continue to climb. They've reached more than 44,000 just in China alone today. But the good news is that the rate at which these confirmed cases are coming in has slowed down. And they've slowed down dramatically outside of Hubei province, which is the epicenter of the entire outbreak. So it shows that these quarantine measures have started to take effect. The rate at which people are cured and getting released is also increasing. So at this point, there are five times the number of people who have been cured and released than those that have died as we go further and further into the outbreak. And China's chief epidemiologist, Zhou Nanshan, said this week that he expected the number of total cases to peak sometime this month. I would take all of this, the numbers, Zhou Nanshan's predictions, with a big grain of salt, partially because the capacity by which authorities can screen and test people for COVID-19, the new coronavirus, has been extremely limited in the hardest hit areas. But overall, the trend is positive.
Well, and it's what health officials hope for, right? Because that's what happened with SARS, is that it just petered out on its own.
Right. The thing that's frightening about COVID-19 is that it seems much more contagious than SARS.
And you said that some of the thinking is that quarantining people or keeping people in one area seems to be working. But we're also hearing from health officials, one who's advising the WHO, that a quarantine is one of the worst things that you can do because then people, you know, can so readily affect other people around them. But it sounds like you're saying, just to be clear, that the thinking there is that this isolation is working.
It's certainly been credited with slowing down the spread of the virus to the rest of China and thus the rest of the world. And so we've seen the number of confirmed cases outside of the epicenter drop dramatically this week. But it's also meant that it's much harder to get supplies and medical help into the epicenter. And you may have very likely put uninfected, healthy people with infected people, particularly in these new mass quarantine centers that authorities are building in the city of Wuhan, where this virus started. It's not a coincidence that the death rate from the virus is twice as high in Hubei province, where you have about half of the number of confirmed cases globally. It's probably because there is a huge shortage of medical supplies and doctors there right now. So you're much more likely to die in Hubei province from this virus simply because of a lack of medical care.
China's president Xi Jinping toured Beijing in a face mask earlier this week. That was quite a picture that went around the world. What was going on with the president's tour? Was he trying to send a signal that he was in charge and things were okay? Because the message that came out is that he had a face mask on.
Definitely. He was trying to send this message that he was in charge and that the efforts to combat this virus were serious. One of the big criticisms early on was that the local government in the city of Wuhan didn't do enough early enough to curtail the virus. But now that national authorities and President Xi Jinping have been alerted to the gravity of this problem, they have taken every measure to combat this virus, perhaps going overboard, according to some critics. Xi Jinping had also been criticized this week because he had largely disappeared from the public eye. Normally, he graces the front page headlines in all of the state newspapers. He basically disappeared from all of those outlets for several days just as the virus outbreak was getting worse and worse. And people wondered, what exactly is he doing, if not doing something to combat the virus? Where is he in this moment of need? So him stepping out in a face mask, meeting with these doctors, going to a research center, being able to video chat with doctors in Wuhan without going there himself, showed that he was personally invested in this effort and that officials all over the place, down to the village level, had to be very diligent in monitoring confirmed cases and making sure it didn't spread.
Well, the WHO announced that a group of experts have arrived in China to help contain the epidemic. Is Beijing, is Xi Jinping receptive to this? Or is there a willingness to work with them?
There is, but there has been some hesitancy in accepting outside, particularly American help. That comes down to a few factors. One of the factors I've heard from epidemiologists is this unwillingness to show that China needs help. It wants to project that it has this issue under control and doesn't need outside experts. The second is there's been some local competition among virologists and scientists within China who want to be the first to sequence the virus, to develop a vaccine, to publish papers on it. And so there's some antipathy to letting in outside competition on this topic, which is completely counterproductive in a time of a public health crisis like this. But mostly it's because China, I think, has been suspicious of letting in Western foreign scientists to take over this effort and, by some accounts, have delayed extending a formal invitation to these experts. The American CDC, for example, has extended an offer to come to China, and they say they have yet to hear back as to whether China will let their researchers go in.
That's NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing. Emily, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. Airbnb has gotten into trouble for rentals that aren't as advertised. The company's CEO is now promising to verify every single listing.
Very few internet companies have attempted to verify the information on their platform. And so I think this is a fairly important move that we're making.
That's next time on Here and Now.